for the second of two oral arguments. And the second matter on our calendar, State of Minnesota versus Joel Orvin Torgerson, who is the appellant, A-20-1140. And we do not have counsel, no briefing for the respondents. So, of course, Mr. Lozo, you'll have the floor for 15 minutes. I'll assume you won't disagree with yourself, so you will not need any rebuttal time. And so you'll notice the clock in the corner, of course, and I will have you state your name for the record when you begin. And so at this time, you may identify yourself and proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, I'm Adam Lozo, and I represent the appellant, Joel Torgerson. As you know, the prosecution did not file an argument supporting Mr. Torgerson's convictions. However, I chose to maintain my request for argument because the case raises some interesting and somewhat unusual legal issues, but I want to start by emphasizing the simplest way for this court to decide the entire case. The state did not prove an element of the ordinance violations for which Torgerson was convicted. The element that requires the state to prove that Torgerson had been notified in writing of the ordinance provision he was violating. Because that element was not proven, both convictions must be reversed, and this court need not reach either the second or third issue raised in the brief. The ordinances Torgerson was convicted of violating include as an offense element that he maintained the alleged nuisance, quote, after being notified in writing by first-class mail of a violation of any provision of this chapter. The record contains the two letters the city sent Torgerson, and therefore there's direct evidence of exactly what the city notified him of. The notice element was unproven for either offense. First, with regard to section 92.16e, neither letter mentions section 92.16 whatsoever. He was never notified of a violation of that provision, and the state could not prove that element. Second, the letters did not notice a single violation of section 92.21, the letters did notice a single violation of section 92.21, trees growing in gutters, but the state presented no evidence that Torgerson maintained that violation. To the contrary, the state submitted evidence showing that condition had been remedied, and the court made no finding that Torgerson maintained that nuisance condition, which was the only violation the city had notified him of. I'll just note
Mr.
also...
Lozo, this,
yes?
Just to clarify, I was looking particularly at the 92.99 requires that an individual maintain nuisance... that an individual maintain a nuisance after being notified in writing of a violation of any provision of this chapter. And so my question is, that seemed rather broad, and maybe there's competing provisions, but wouldn't that suggest that as long as he's notified of any violation, that would satisfy the notice requirement?
Well, it would satisfy the notice requirement if he's prosecuted for a violation of the chapter that he's notified of, of the provision that he's notified of. But I certainly don't think that if he is notified of a violation of something completely different from what he ends up being charged with and convicted of doing, that would satisfy that offense element. I don't think, I think that there's two reasons for that. First of all, I think that just the plain language of the offense element that says he has to be notified in writing of a violation, as you said, of any provision of this chapter. But I don't think that it makes any sense as an interpretive, in an interpretive way to say that language means that so long as he's notified of any violation, he can thereafter be charged with and convicted of violating any other provision he wasn't notified of. So it is true that he was notified of some violations, but the only one that he was notified of, he remedied. And I'll point out, it's the fact he remedied that violation isn't just proven by the exhibits that the state presented at trial. It's also proven by the fact that the city sent him a second letter, which did not mention that he did not notify him of any continued violation of that provision. 92.21 is notified in the first letter. It is not notified in the second letter, and the condition that they said was violating 92.21 is also not notified in the second letter. So the two things that he was eventually charged with and then eventually found guilty of doing, he was never notified at all of one of those provisions, and the other provision he was notified of, timely remedied it in accordance with the city's instructions, and the city's second letter shows, and its evidence shows, that he did not maintain that condition.
Mr. Mozo, yes. I realize you started out by indicating the easier route for this court to rule, and you then started referencing the notice, and I assume you might next get to the other elements, perhaps the other issue you raised. But my question is, from appellate standpoint, and well, from your client standpoint, can a person be in violation of the ordinance if the ordinance itself is not properly certified or created, which you've raised, of course, in issue number three? And how would we avoid that? Wouldn't that be jumping ahead of the issue of the elements itself if it's not properly? And secondly, do you have any specific legal authority with regard to municipal ordinances and criminal enforceability as it relates to a sufficiency of evidence issue that you've raised here?
Well, I'll answer your first question first, which is that I think that this court could decide the case on either ground. I think that certainly the state never showed that the ordinance was not validly enacted. And in fact, I think the only evidence that was produced shows that it wasn't. I don't think that if the court resolves it on insufficiency, that the court needs to reach that, because either way, his convictions have to be overturned and vacated, and he can't be re-prosecuted. So either way, he will not have a conviction. He will have no finding of guilt. I think that that resolves the case on an independent ground that wouldn't require the court to reach the enactment issue. But if the court decides that it needs to reach the enactment issue, I think that Mr. Torgerson's argument clearly prevails there as well. But to go back to your question, I know I didn't answer your second question, and I wonder if you would re-ask it, because I'm not quite sure I understood it on the first asking.
I know there's reference, I believe, perhaps in your brief, to the Akeley case and the Pilgrim case as it relates to the statutory presumptions, the prima facie basis and the conclusive proof. My question is, perhaps separate from that, is there any specific authority that references the lack of improperly enacted ordinance having an adverse effect on the criminal prosecution?
Well, first of all, I'll remind the court that Mr. Torgerson was prosecuted only for violating the city ordinances. So there was nothing else that he was charged with or convicted of violating. So if those ordinances had no legal effect, I think quite clearly he can't be convicted of, should never have been charged, of violating them. I'll point the court to on page 33 of my brief for that specific question, the W.H. Barber case that talks about failure to comply with a requirement to publish an ordinance for enactment would render the ordinance ineffective. I think in the specific terms of this case, the ineffectiveness is particularly clear because the ordinance itself contains the express term that it has to be published in the city's official newspaper to be effective. So that would be similar to the Union Public Service Company case that talks about by the terms of ordinance number 165, it did not become operative or go into effect until published. I guess the most direct authority would be the W.H. Barber case. But I also think, just as a matter of principle, if an ordinance is not effective, or if it's not effective, the city cannot rely on it because it's simply doesn't govern anything. It's not effective. There's no way a person can be prosecuted for violating an ordinance that legally doesn't even exist. So if the ordinance was never enacted, if it was never legally effective, his prosecution has to be overturned. His conviction has to be overturned, and obviously the case dismissed if there's no ordinance that is effective that the city can charge him under. And I'll also point out to the court that in issue three, the way that it was sort of, issue three talks about whether there's a conclusive presumption that this ordinance was validly enacted. But I think I would point out that even though there is no conclusive presumption, I think that this court should also, and that the record supports, not determining that there wasn't even a prima facie showing that this ordinance was effective. And the reason, and for that reason, this court should simply reverse rather if it reaches this issue rather than reversing and remanding. And the reason for that is that the parties fully litigated this and the state wasn't able to support to provide any evidence that under the statute would make even a prima facie showing because what they submitted was a copy of something that's not certified. And the statute requires that if you're going to try to prove that an ordinance is valid, you have under this specific statute, because obviously they couldn't provide any of the other evidence of publication that they would need to show that this ordinance was valid. They couldn't and they didn't. And so the statute says, well, here are the things that you can prove that you can submit to make a prima facie showing and to establish a conclusive presumption. There's several arguments.
Does the statute say, the way you're phrasing it, I think might be different than the way the statute phrases it. It sounds like your argument is that the statute says, this is the exclusive way to establish by conclusive proof that there was adoption of an ordinance. And my reading of the statute doesn't exclude other possible evidence that someone might present to establish that this ordinance was in fact adopted. Is it your reading of the statute that this is the only way you can establish that an ordinance was adopted is through the conclusive proof and the categories listed in the statute?
No. I'm sorry if I misspoke there. One thing the state could have done to show that this was a validly enacted and effective ordinance is to come to court with proof that this ordinance had ever been published like it said it had to be. They were unable to provide any of that evidence. And in fact, the defense attorney was able to elicit evidence from multiple people that it had not been published. The city clerk said that he searched the records and couldn't find any evidence that had ever been published in the newspaper as the terms of the ordinance require for it to be valid. The city clerk also testified that he contacted the publisher of the city's official newspaper, who also looked into the issue and couldn't find any evidence of it. Council members and the mayor who testified, none of them could provide testimony that or evidence that this had ever been published. And the ordinance itself didn't comply with what would have been the typical process for validly enacting an ordinance. The mayor signing it, that didn't happen. Yep.
I understand, and I'm sorry if my mic isn't here. You can't hear me, but okay. You can hear me. Great. Wonderful. I understand that you're arguing that the ordinance itself on its face requires that it be published in the newspaper. So that's one way to establish that it's in effect. That's slightly different than whether it was actually adopted, which seems to be the focus of the statute, is whether something was adopted, not whether it then takes effect, because you can adopt something that says this takes effect upon some other condition being met. So I see those as slightly different. So I guess my question is, in order to show that something was actually adopted, is it sufficient to have the mayor or city council person or the city clerk say, yep, I was at the meeting, we all read it, it was adopted, I'm looking at Exhibit 2, and this is exactly word for word what was adopted. Is that conclusive proof, or is that a method that someone can use to establish the same thing that statute is designed to address, whether or not an ordinance was adopted?
If the only question in the case were adoption, I think that testimony could, if credited, establish that. Yep. But Section 599.13 and the issue in this case is not limited to adoption. Section 599.13 talks about establishing proof of the regularity of an ordinance's adoption and publication. And also, I'll note that it is not sufficient in this case. At least specifically in this case, if the ordinance was validly adopted by the council, because it to take any legal effect, it also had to be published. Now, I think there's a good argument that that's required by statute, but here that doesn't need to be reached because it's required by the ordinance itself. And so I do think that the example you give could provide that type of evidence of adoption, but that's not the only issue in this case. That's not the determinative issue in this case. And the city was unable to provide any evidence of effective publication or of any publication, which is required by statute to be effective.
Are you aware of any authority that requires that the specific ordinance be published, or is it enough for the clerk of the city to say it's our standard operating procedure to publish everything in the paper?
Well, first of all, I'll point out that that didn't happen in this case. There wasn't any testimony from the clerk saying, well, this must have been published because that's our standard procedure. In fact, the clerk wasn't even employed at the city at the time that this was purportedly adopted. But to go back to your first question and hopefully I think answer it, the authority that I gave to Judge Sleater before talks about the fact that without publication, an ordinance, at the very least, when it specifically requires publication by its terms to take effect, without publication, it doesn't have legal effect. Again, that's Union Public Service Company, that's W.H. Barber. Pilgrim, a case discussed in my brief, talked about how that zoning map, that's a 599-13 case, but the zoning map that didn't comply with that wasn't entitled to conclusive validity. So excuse me, I see that my time is up. Can I just finish?
You can finish your thoughts, point? Mr. Lozier. Yes, sure.
Thank you. So just the final thought is that by the ordinance's own terms, it was required to be published to be effective. That's similar to W.H. Barber and to Union Public Service Company. There was no evidence that that happened. There was only evidence that it didn't. And for the reasons in my brief, the court erred in relying on the statute, and this court should reverse. And I'm happy to answer any further questions, of course.
Either of my colleagues have any other questions? Appears not. Very good. Well, thank you, Mr. Lozel. We'll take the matter under advisement and issue a written order within the statutory timeline. You have a good day.